recording. All right, so my name is Emin Rogers. Today is the 19th of October. We're at Madison Public Library and we're listening to Dana Schreiber tell us her story from the Dow riots 50 years ago.
Okay. Hi. This is a very wonderful opportunity for me to be able to tell this story, and I know I'll leave a lot out, but there are things that are vivid in my memory that I'm glad I get to recall. I was a sophomore in 1967, and as a freshman, I had learned more about the anti-war movement and participated in a Dow demonstration when Dow was recruiting at, I believe, the Law Library. And there was a group demonstrating, but it was small and it was quiet, and that was my first experience. Over the following year, I became more involved in the anti-war movement and more concerned with all of the intricacies that involved our country. The night before the Dow demonstration, which we knew would be a big one, but we didn't really know what was going to happen. I don't think anyone anticipated violence. The San Francisco Mime Troupe came to the Union Theater. They were a left-leaning theater group that went around the country anti-establishment, and they did skits about anti-war movements, questioning authority, student rights, civil rights, etc., women's rights, which we're just starting. It was a great performance. The Union Theater was packed. Everyone was psyched. At the end of the performance, they came out, got sort of choked up, on stage. All of them came out, and catch your breath here. They said, "We know you're going to demonstrate tomorrow, and we know you're demonstrating against Dow recruiting on campus, and we want you to know that we'll be with you, and we'll be marching with you." And they said, "Remember, this is your university, and if you don't like it, change it. And if you can't change it, shut it down." And the crowd went wild. Everybody was so fired up. It was just the most incredible feeling to have some organization with some credibility give us that kind of support. So people were very fired up by that experience, and I have not heard people mention that previously. So the next day, we met at the Library Mall. There was a rally. I cannot tell you who spoke, but I'm sure Paul Soglin was one of the speakers, and one of the most inspiring speakers. He spoke with confidence, he spoke the facts, and he spoke encouraging us to stand up for what we believed in. So we were very fired up, and the San Francisco Mime Troupe was at the top of the front of the march with their different musical instruments, and they were jumping around, being kind of mime-like, and we marched up the hill, and it did get bolder as we went, and we sang, and we chanted, and we went to the Commerce Building, and I must say, I was not well-versed. I was just on the side against the war and against Dow. And we got to the Commerce Building, and people went into the building. And I went along with them and went into the hallway, to the very back of the hallway. And the hallway started filling up really quickly. And it was a long hallway, and it was packed. And I suddenly had a really scared feeling, and I decided to get out. And as I came out of the building, the police were going in, and things just turned ugly. I can't even describe it. The police came in riot gear. They did say, "Please leave." They didn't say, "Please." They said, "Leave the building. This is an illegal assembly." And people didn't leave. Some people left. And I really don't know what the explosion was, because it all started to erupt inside the building. And at that point, I was just coming outside of the building. And people were screaming, and there was banging of heads that you could literally hear with nightsticks. There was blood. There was chaos. And then there was tear gas. And none of us that I know of had a clue what tear gas was. And it was horrible. It hurt. It was suffocating. It stung your eyes. You couldn't see. And they were gassing randomly. And the air was filled with it. And people walking by that were just changing classes at that time of day were also gassed. So a lot of innocent people, not that we weren't innocent, but a lot of people that were not participating in this action were also attacked. There was no discrimination between who was part of the demonstration and who was just somebody on campus. I have asthma, and the tear gas made me really sick. I had a lot of trouble breathing. I do remember getting some help, but it took a while. And I was helped down Bascom Hill and into the Rathskeller, where they cleaned out my eyes. And I had, of course, an inhaler on me, and people made sure I was okay. And people were just devastated. They were crying. They were shocked. They were angry. They didn't know what had happened. It just was so fast and so brutal. And the police were so angry, and the riot gear was so alienating and frightening. And I remember having a boyfriend at the time that was fairly radical in his politics. And he said to me, we're organizing. You won't be seeing very much of me anymore. And I didn't really know what it meant, but my guess is he was part of what became SDS on campus. And I really didn't see much of him, and everything between us was very cryptic. I was taking a course at the time called The Politics of Campaigns and Revolutions, The Rhetoric of Campaigns and Revolutions. The professor was Rosenfeld, and it was in the education, School of Education. And after the Dow demonstration, he showed us a video of how riots evolve. And he played the Dow demonstration tape from the press about how, as we marched up the hill and the crowd got bigger and the enthusiasm grew, the intensity and the commitment took over. And so I think in my mind, between the great buildup we got at the San Francisco Mime Troupe, the buildup of this anti-war movement, the speeches beforehand that, you know, encouraged us to go forward, that we had support, and then having watched this video in class, seeing how we evolved into this huge, spirited crowd, and how I believe the police, who had no riot training that I know of, lost it, and people's lives were at risk. And in the end, I can speak for very many people, we were all radicalized by this event. We were against the war, but after that, we were committed to doing whatever we could, in whatever way we could, to stop this war. At the end, 20 years later, when we had a reunion, there was an open mic, and many people spoke about how their experience with Dow and their experience post-Dow changed their lives and turn them into people that worked for progressive social change and justice and questioning authority, myself included.
Thank you for sharing that. That was an emotional part as well, and I appreciate
it. I didn't think it would be.
It is emotional to look back, no matter what, and this was particularly.
Well, if I could tell you that having people in authority, which was the mime troupe, even though they weren't, mm-hmm. you know.
But they were on a stage.
Here, they were, exactly. They were on a stage. We were young. We were innocent. We were bordering on what is going on mm-hmm. and what. How do we deal with this? And we had, at that time, the professors in the university were starting to talk about the war and the politics. And so there was a whole climate in the liberal arts school of support. And when it was over and things had changed, there was, I remember, a demonstration at the library mall, and a group of professors, I don't know how many there were, sent a message to Paul Sagan, who was speaking, mm-hmm. that said, "We are here, we are surrounding you, we support you, and we will make sure you are safe." And it was pretty much, wow, we're not crazy, you know, and we, what we're doing is a good thing and the right thing. Mm-hmm. So there was, you know, it built from there. Uh-huh. And I do think, unintentionally, the police and the tear gas and their behavior changed, to me, I would say, a generation. I know that's an exaggeration because it just was my environment. But now that I'm on Facebook and telling people about this opportunity to do this storytelling, people are coming out of the woodworks telling their stories and how much it changed their lives.
Yeah.
And somebody, when I came in, said, "Oh, you know, were you a part of it?" And I said, "Yes." And she said, "Oh, lucky you." And I said, "Well, it wasn't really..." Oh, she said, "Oh, that's great." And I said, "Well, it wasn't really great at the time. It was... it threw us all. But I'm glad that I had that opportunity to figure out a direction in my life that I don't think I would have gone in otherwise."
Yeah. Well, you said you were involved at least in more left-leaning thinking even before that, and that you'd taken part in an earlier
demonstration
at the law building. Yeah. So you think this just accelerated your path, or...?
Well, I didn't really know much about the war in high school, and I didn't really know much about politics in high school. Mm-hmm. And my freshman year here, I learned a lot. I learned a lot about I learned who the Democrats and the Republicans were, you know. I learned through courses in liberal arts about, you know, the history of some things that have been gone on that I didn't know about. And I did also, as a freshman, I had come here knowing a woman that was a student here. She was a senior, I think. And through her, I met a lot of people that were already fairly left-leaning and hung out in the Ratskeller. And they'd sit around and talk politics all the time. I mean, that's really what went on in there. And so I learned a lot, both in class and in the Ratskeller, and got to meet people who were older and had thought things through, who had been involved in the civil rights movement, which was no longer happening on campus when I got here. Mm-hmm. It was a pretty active movement before I got here, but I don't know why it was no longer, at least it wasn't in my sphere. But I think I've always been on the side of progressive social change. I think I've always been for the underdog and felt for how unfair things were in our country. So I think that was always... I'm Jewish, and before I came to go to college, The rabbi of our temple invited all the seniors in high school to his house to talk about moving on. And he talked about these issues. He didn't exactly talk about the war, but he talked about making a difference and, you know, speaking up. And he said, you know, he said, Jews have always been at the avant-garde of social change. And, you know, it was really, I'm not sure what he meant to tell us, but it was fight for what you believe in. Get out there, speak up, and be proud that your history is people that have done that. And I think that was really stuck with me.
Yeah. And a lot of people trace kind of that culture of protest and of speaking up in Madison to yesterday, 50 years ago. And I guess I'm kind of wondering, did you feel that change over time, or was it like that day everything was different in Madison and that's how it was going to be from then on?
No, I think the civil rights movement and the anti-war movement were the catalysts for people getting more involved in social change. I think there was a core of people that thought that way all along. And there was, you know, as opposed to what's going on now on campuses that I am aware of, there was a welcome to talk about these things and think about these things and act on these things. And I think, though, for me and for many of my friends, Dow was the turning point. Mm-hmm. Because we had never been threatened in such a way. And we were scared and angry, and you know, I mean, I did an interview for a video that was made, student video, on the AMRC bombing, and you know, in retrospect, and I was here for that, and I was part of the Mifflin Street anti-war group of hippie people that, you know, we had the co-op, and we had free love and, you know, all sorts of hippie things that we didn't have growing up and didn't really exist, and except maybe in a beatnik sort of way. And that's always been a part of where I've leaned, but I think we made a lot of mistakes. I think we judged inappropriately sometimes. I don't think we were as well-versed as we could have been. I'm speaking for myself. You know, many of us jump to conclusions, which you still see people doing today. And I have some regrets, but there's nothing I can think of about that Dow experience that I regret. I don't think I was out of line. I don't think I did anything wrong. And I feel good that I was a part of it, and I feel bad that we became a us against them community, because the police were, I mean, I don't know if it had been campus police, things would have been different, but it was city police, and it just really polarized things, really.
Right.
And we didn't have a government that was sympathetic. We also had, you know, something that I became more obvious to me over time. The New York Jews were the problem. That was what they blamed the radicalization on. You know, well, Paul Sadlin was Jewish, but he was Chicago. But at that time, there were a lot of New Yorkers here. They've since changed the quota system. So, and we were a lot of the people that were out there and a lot of the people speaking. And years later, I was on, there were four bombers for the AMRC bombing. One of them, David Fine, was caught and was gonna go to trial. And so the attorneys did a thing where, like, we all met in a room and you sat and you did phone calls screening potential jurors and asking them questions so that it could help within the pool who to look for to get on the jury. And we had questions we had to ask them, and the questions were versed, so it was the same question but asked different ways all along. And I did it, you know, people volunteered to do it, and you do it in shifts, and I did it several times. And I was constantly amazed at how hated the New York Jews were. They were blamed for everything. And this is like the Wisconsin constituents, you know, this is the group the poll was, where the jury was being pulled from. And I always heard it, but there was real hostility and blaming the New York Jews. It's the outsiders, get them out of here. They're the troublemakers. And they were the liberal arts students. And I never really talked about it with a lot of people, but if you looked at the people that were the most vocal, it was about predominantly, I think, Jewish people. And a lot of us were bigger city people, you know. And so I don't know how much that was something that I was conscious of. I'm not sure that it was an accurate
assessment.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's really interesting, especially after you said that, your rabbi sat you down as your
go
senior
for, yeah.
to go say
right.
something.
Well, that's what made me think to tell you that, because when I didn't really, I know that there was a backlash of get those New Yorkers out of here, and New Yorkers that were coming here were Jewish, mm-hmm. And I can't give you a reason why they chose Wisconsin, but that was, a coincidence, and I mean, Soglin was, I mean, I thought he was fabulous. He was my hero. He was the best speaker. I still think he speaks very well. But he was so concise, and he knew what he was talking about, and he wasn't just a protester. And I think he really, and he was Jewish. And, so the fact that he stood out, and then he was our alder. He was the first. He was called the Boy Alder. He was on To Tell the Truth. Do you remember? Do you know that show?
I don't know.
There used to be this TV show where a panel, and there are three guests, and each one stood up and said, "My name is so and so. My name," and they all said the same name, and then the panel asked questions till they found out who the real person was. And Soglin was on that show, To Tell the Truth, and that was maybe when he was Boy Mayor. I can't remember if he was mayor by then, and it was. Will the real Paul Soglin please stand up? And each of these three people stood up and said, "My name is Paul Soglin." And it's really funny. So as he was one of the first youthful mayors that I was aware of, by that happening and him just becoming alder, he made local government real to me. It was not when I was growing up. I knew nothing about government. But suddenly I knew my alder. Mm-hmm. And then he helped us figure out what government was about. And that was when I felt like I grew up, when I was part of my local government.
Yeah. So you knew him personally then?
I did. I lived in his neighborhood. I was a friend of his, and still am. But he had two dogs, Kafka and I can't believe it. Kafka and another radical. Those dogs went with him everywhere.
Oh.
I wish I could think of his other dog's name. And. I lived on Mifflin Street, and I was there for the riots there, and part of the co-op, and I lived with people that were radicals, and some stuff was really scary. I had two men that I lived with, they both had shotguns that they slept with over their heads, which I didn't like at all. To be perfectly frank, I no longer care, but, it was a lot of dope smoking and nobody, I mean, I still don't believe that dope is a harmful drug. I think it wears off really quickly, and I'm not one of those that thinks that leads to other things or you lose your mind when you smoke dope. But, you know, we'd sit around and smoke dope and talk politics. And the weirdest thing was my house was one of the houses that had a television. And we had all these riots going on with Mifflin Street. And we'd be out there either at the university rioting against Vietnam or on Mifflin Street because the police were coming into our neighborhood. And at 5:30, everyone would come to our house because Walter Cronkite came on. And we were almost always on Walter Cronkite. Uh-huh. They had a reporter here. So we sort of stopped the riots and come and watch ourselves on TV. And that was pretty funny. So there was, this is post-Dow. Dow was the turning point, the radical moment. Mifflin Street was all part of the 60s of birth control being available, people smoking dope, talking about politics, student rights, patient rights, women's rights. It was a rights time. But we became community. And that's what changed in my mind, that we were now a community. And so when we did come back, you know, at 5:30 to our house and watch Walter, who was our most trusted person, I mean, we thought he was fabulous and fair. And of course, he was on our side. But it was a lifestyle, you know, as well as anything else. But that doesn't mean our protesting wasn't genuine. I mean, I would say that, you know, people say, oh, you were just, you know, yeah, people would say, you're the political panty raiders. You know, before you, it was the fraternity brothers with the panty raids where girls at dorms would throw their underpants out at boys rioting in the street, the fraternity boys. Those were called panty raids. They said, well, you're just the political panty raids. But I don't think that was true. I mean, there might have been people that joined for the dope or the sex. I don't know. But I think, and I still do think that, you know, there's a genuine core of people that are and were and are, you know, really trying to make this a better world and really sick of what's going on now. You know? So.
Yeah.
And I just see Susan, a friend of mine, came in.
Oh, good.
I knew her from then. So.
Oh, good. Well, I wanted to ask you a couple more questions, but I won't keep you too long.
Okay. I'm sorry if I'm going on and on.
No, I'm really, really enjoying hearing your story. It comes together in interesting ways. I wanted to ask you if you remember, like, later that night or later that week after the 18th, what the mood was or what the feeling was, and you said later you ended up becoming a community, and that was the reason for that. But did that happen when people were washing out your eyes at the Rathskeller, or
that we were community,
that you became really cohesive as a community? Yeah,
I think the cohesion started with the rallies,
mm-hmm.
when a group of people that shared a belief got together, and we had such powerful speakers. And we had university professors who had some credibility. I think it's, for me, that's when it started. And it evolved, but it evolved because we had common, I think it did start with Dow in a way that I've never thought about before. But you see, a lot of us were Rathskeller people, and we knew each other already.
Mm-hmm.
And, but I think it evolved. I don't think it was an instant community.
Do you remember much from later that night or the next day or later that week?
Well, what I remember most is that, and I'm reading this on Facebook from my friends, calling my parents, which most of us did. And some people got parents who were appalled at how we had been treated. My father was not. He said, if you're doing something illegal and the police tear gas you, It's because you're not listening to what the police are telling you, and they have no other way to get you to stop. And he said, and I said, well, what about the people walking, changing classes that were getting tear gas that were also changed by that experience? And he said, you know, if somebody jumps in a pool to help someone who's drowning and they get splashed, that's just, if people around them get splashed, that's just part of what happens. And my father was very against what I was doing. And yet never pulled me out. He never. But I just remember then that I knew I didn't have any support from home, and that I didn't need it because I wasn't there. My home was in New York, you know, so this was my other home. And, you know, what I remember most is people just being stunned, and that went on for a few days, and that this man that I really cared a lot about was, you know, pretty much gone. And I did, you know, over time, as we stayed in touch, find out that he just got involved in underground politics that he was afraid. He didn't want people to know because he thought they might arrest him.
Look
at him,
yeah.
Sheena coming in?
Oh, I think she may have already done her story.
Oh, have you seen her? Oh.
They're doing them at that table, I believe, too, so.
So, you know, and so I think, you know, because of we were all so different and came from different places, and, you know, it was overwhelming, you know. I mean, just put yourself in that position. I mean, I don't know your history, but you come and you speak up against something and you get support. And it's something that you believe in. Mm-hmm. Because this was the other part of it that wasn't as obvious to me, but it was becoming more obvious. Our friends were being drafted. You know, mm-hmm. The student deferments were, I think they were still there, but if you didn't go to college, you went to Vietnam. And you died in Vietnam. Or you came back knowing you were fighting and maybe getting harmed for something you didn't believe in. And there was no lottery, it was a draft. And I lived with a man my senior year who was facing the draft. And every night he kept like four handkerchiefs under the bed. He had allergies. Mm-hmm. And every night he would take the handkerchief that had been down there the longest and tie it around his face and sleep with that on his face. So that when he went to his physical, he would be as sick as he could be, you know. I had a friend who was rich enough to have braces put on all his teeth so they wouldn't take him, because what were they going to do with someone with braces out in the field in Vietnam? You know, I mean, people were desperate because they were being drafted. And I do believe that if there was a draft now, we wouldn't be in Iraq or Afghanistan.
Yeah, you might be right about that.
But nobody has to go, you know. It's just the people that need the money. So, but no, after that, I don't remember much. I just remember I didn't have support from my parents, and I lost my boyfriend, and the rallies continued. And they were more frequent, mm-hmm. And we had no impact. You know, I mean, we want to believe that we had something to do with ending the war, but I don't think we did.
So I was listening yesterday to the NPR had a story on in the morning, which was really fascinating. But what they got into is they said that kicked off a whole string of rallies all over the country.
Yes.
So maybe it did have an impact, even if it wasn't the one you wanted.
Right. Well, I think we radicalized people. I think we changed people. I think we were changed. But in the end, I think the war had more to do with the war machine and the politics. I don't think the protests may have had some influence, but I don't think they were what we had thought they would be.
Do you mind if I ask you, you know, the Women's March?
Can I go to the bathroom?
Oh, yeah, go ahead.
I'll be right back.
I'll just pause this.
I just had some coffee before I came.
Here we go. All right, we're back with Dana Schreiber. I'm Emin Rogers. It's still October 19th. And we were talking about the Dow riots of 50 years ago.
50 years,
wow. I know. But we were just talking about the aftermath that later that week and how the demonstrations kicked up in both size and frequency. Would you, I'm trying to figure out how to word my question here. Would you say that the riots themselves kind of galvanized campus into participating in this, or would you say that they changed a lot of minds in that moment? I should probably clarify that, but
I think they definitely did both, but I also think they polarized the campus.
Mm-hmm.
So that engineering was not part of the movement.
Uh-huh.
Liberal arts was where the action developed and evolved, but we definitely were the enemy of the people that would say we're here to get an education. We're not here to be, you know, and we kind of felt, and I think I'm talking for more than myself, and I know I am, that this was part of the education, you know, like learning what the world is about and how to participate. And so I think it polarized a lot of people, and it polarized Madison.
I'm thinking about the Women's March.
Yes, what? In what way?
Just that is probably the biggest part of the biggest demonstration that I've been able to be a part of.
Me too.
Maybe a lot of people, actually. That was a big one. And I'm wondering if you felt any kind of reflection back to the Dow and its aftermath.
No.
No.
The reflection I feel is the idea of community and the idea of, you know, the women's rights did not come out of Dow at all, and did not really exist then.
Sure.
There were feminists, but they weren't called feminists, and we still were the generation, maybe one of the last few of women raised. I mean, I was sent here to get a husband. I wasn't sent here. I mean, they called it the MRS, you know. And but many of us stayed here after college or went to communities like Berkeley or places where there was political action. And I can't really, without thinking about it, put my finger on when the whole women's rights issues started. I think a lot of it had to do with healthcare, and that was my field. I went into, I worked at a free clinic and was very involved with women's reproductive rights. But you know, we were talking about this. Ironically, what happened was, so in 1970, when we were still fighting the war, but more just trying to, I don't know, be different. We were hippies. We would be out protesting as people, and then we'd come home and the women would cook the dinner and take care of the men.
Mm-hmm.
So, and we all laugh now about how ironic it was that it was the men that really were in charge. We didn't have women speaking at the rallies. We didn't have women participating in an authoritarian way, I mean, as a leader. And I think in 69, 70 is when, I think that, you know, frankly, I think the birth control pill really helped galvanize women's movement because we weren't so threatened by having sex, you know. I mean, the women paid the price, if you know. And then the university started having classes on women's rights and women's issues. And then they had the actually a school of women, of feminine, I don't know what it's called.
Gender women's studies, yeah.
Which was profound. And there were years that I would say the 70s when Our Bodies Ourselves came out. I don't know if you're familiar with that book.
Yeah, yeah.
And women were organizing, you know, finally seeing our strength and our power and what it meant to work together. And, you know, just an aside, it went right after the bombing. Everybody in my community was freaked out because nobody we knew was involved in anything like that. And there wasn't a hint that anybody knew who these people were.
Mm-hmm.
So there were two meetings, and the FBI was all over my neighborhood, the Mifflin Street neighborhood. And we were scared. And so there were two meetings. And the first night, the meeting was at the Doyle School. And it was what to do about the bombing, you know, what was going on, and what did this mean for our neighborhood, because we were all scared. And I didn't pay attention then, but it was mostly men that spoke. What else was going on was it was the first time we celebrated the 19th Amendment, the anniversary of the women getting the right to mm-hmm. vote in August. So this group of women that had organized as a women's consciousness group, is what we call ourselves, there was a newspaper called Takeover. I don't know if you ever heard of it. It was a bizarre, underground, very radical newspaper. And they were going to do a women's health edition, right, because of this anniversary. And we were all going to go out, and what we called it then was hawking it. That was what when you sold newspapers, mm-hmm. you called it hawking the newspaper. And so we had a meeting the next night about this, about what we were going to do. And I noticed for the first time, the meeting with men and women, and it's just my observation, the men would get up, say something, one at a time, say it again, and then sit down. And then another man would stand up and say the same thing that the other man said. I mean, it was like, and I don't recall women standing up and speaking. And then the next night, it was all women. And I suddenly noticed the contrast. A woman would get up, say something, sit down. A woman would get up and respond to her and sit down. And it was so extremely different to me. And it was an eye opener. That was, you know, almost a Dow moment in my mind to see how we were being manipulated and who we could really be and what progress we could make if we just trusted ourselves, you know. And what ended up happening was the AMRC bombers wrote a letter, they called it a manifesto, and sent it to Takeover. And Takeover decided to cover our women's issue with the manifesto. So here we were, all these women out hawking this newspaper that now had the bombing on the cover instead of women's issues. And I was up at the Capitol. And believe me, they were not happy up at the Capitol. And here I am, you know, trying to sell a newspaper about the bombing, you know, when that was never the intent. It was nuts that we let them get away with that, you know, but the bombing really did. And it not only was the scariest thing, I mean, the idea of somebody dying over what we were doing, it just never entered anyone's mind. And you know, that was a major turning point. That, as far as many of my friends, shut down the anti-war movement. It just put the fear of the FBI was around, somebody died, you know. And So then we sort of moved more into the women's consciousness issues and women's health issues and birth control and education for women about their bodies and, you know, support for, you know, giving women more confidence. And that was where I was active for a long time. And one of the things that was really important to us was that we stopped calling each other girls and we started calling each other women. Mm-hmm. Because girls is very infantilizing. And we weren't girls. And we were women. And, you know, people, that's when people say, oh, well, it's politically correct. And you say, no, it's how we feel. And here we are, 35 plus years later, and everybody's calling each other girl again. You know, even my friend, my very close friend, he's talking about guys and gals, and I said, it's women. And he said, well, if it's guys, and I said, there's no word in my mind that you can say that would infantilize a man, but all you have to do is say girl. And then later on in our conversation, he talked about, he's a chiropractor, and he talked about a fellow chiropractor, and he called her a woman. And I said, see? You call her a woman, you know. So I am very sad to see what I think has been a turnaround in the feminist movement. And I think the Women's March was fabulous. And it again, you know, I'm now in a group of women that I hadn't been for a while. My feeling has been it's time for the next generation to take over. You know, it's time for the younger women to start, you know, holding on to what we've worked so hard for, but certainly Trump and the Women's March was very inspiring, I thought, but we don't know where to go from here. We're in such a bad place. We had so much more say in what went on than we do now. Yeah. And there's still, I mean, when I said to you, our bodies, ourselves, do you know it? That was like, you know, the most profound book. It was so much education. It was so much about who we are. And then they did a book, Ourselves Growing Older, about women, you know, going into perimenopause and menopause and all, and pregnancy and all the things that can happen to you and your body and you and your personal life and you and how you treat in this world. And I don't even see it for sale. I don't know people that are millennials that even know about it. So, but I thought it was very exciting to get the Women's March out. And what was very funny, I think, I have a friend that lives in Switzerland, and he called me in like January, and he said, what are you doing? I said, I'm knitting a pink pussy hat. And he said, I don't think I'm allowed to ask you what that means. Because he hasn't lived in America for over 20 years. And, you know, I mean, that word was never used until this Women's March when it was, you know.
It was a play on something that had happened, I guess.
It was so funny. Yeah. And, you know, something else, you know, did you ever see the Vagina Monologues?
I didn't get to. I was sick.
Well, they come around every Friday, every Valentine's Day. They show
here, yeah.
They here and all over the country. Mm-hmm. And it's very funny because I was telling my mother's friend that. I said, Bernice, they show it all over the country. And she said, all over the country? And I said, Bernice! And they did, one of the skits was about, it's a great, I mean, I highly recommend seeing it. This woman comes out on stage.
I might just jump in because I might stop the recorder because I could talk to you forever about this. But okay. I might just push
are we done with